fun. It was really fun. Right, ladies and gentlemen, mesdames et messieurs, si vous voulez bien, on va débuter la soirée. Alors, je m'appelle René Provost, je suis professeur ici à la faculté de droit de l'Université McGill. Je suis aussi membre du Centre sur les droits de la personne et le pluralisme juridique qui organise cet événement. So it's a real pleasure to welcome you to this other Raoul Wallenberg lecture. As many of you know who Raoul Wallenberg is, and for many people, Raoul Wallenberg embodies the very notion of personal responsibility to act in front of injustice. He was a Swedish businessman who was sent to Hungary in 1944 under still debated circumstances. And when confronted there with the massive deportation of Hungarian Jews towards concentration camps, he started to deliver tens of thousands of so-called protective passports, identifying the bearers as Swedish citizens awaiting repatriation and therefore protecting them from deportation to extermination camps. He rented dozens of buildings and designated them as diplomatic premises, Swedish libraries, Swedish cultural centers with big Swedish flags to put beyond reach those who would have been deported otherwise. There was a direct threat to the massacre of about 115,000 Jews in the Budapest ghetto, and Raoul Wallenberg got in touch with the German commanders and told them that if they went ahead, he would make sure that after the end of the war, they would be prosecuted as war criminals. And in the end, there was no massacre of Jews in the Budapest ghetto. All these efforts were undertaken by Wallenberg without necessarily any official authorization. And so he lacked legal authority and incurred enormous personal risks in these actions. He became hunted by both the Gestapo and the Hungarian fascist militias, but managed to remain free until the liberation of Budapest by Soviet forces in early 1949. The Soviets announced in March 45 that Wallenberg had been killed by pro-Nazi militias earlier that year. But in fact, we learned later that he was arrested by the Soviets and taken to Moscow, where he stayed in the notorious Lubyanka prison for at least 2 years. And for many years, his whereabouts were unknowns. There were reported sightings of Wallenberg in various prisons in the Soviet Union in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and even the 1980s. And it was only relatively recently that declassified documents showed that he apparently died, was killed in 1947 in Lubyanka prison, although that still remains contested to some extent. Well, Wallenberg was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize in 1948 and was recognized by the State of Israel as one of the righteous amongst the nations. He was Canada's very first honorary citizen, named to that honor in 1985. In 1988, the Faculty of Law here created the Wallenberg Lectureship at the instigation of my colleague, Professor Erwin Kotler. And so it seems befitting that I now cede the floor to Professor Kotler to introduce our guest today, Professor Harold Koh. Erwin.
Merci, Monsieur le Président, Honoré Distingué. I noticed amongst us two former Court of Appeal judges, El Honorable Louise Otis and Honorable Joseph Nuss. Thank you for being with us this evening. And as you mentioned, Rene, about Rawalan being an honorary citizen of Canada, he also is an honorary citizen of the United States and Australia and Israel, and we have representatives from those countries who are also with us here this evening. Chers collègues, chers amis, I'm delighted to be able to welcome you along with René to this Raoul Wallenberg Lectureship in Human Rights in remembrance of and in tribute to Canada's first honorary citizen, a hero of humanity whom the United Nations referred to as the greatest humanitarian of the 20th century, the disappeared hero of the Holocaust, who showed how one person with the compassion to care and the courage to act can confront evil, can resist, can prevail, and can thereby transform history. Indeed, Raoul Wallenberg is metaphor and message for some of the contemporary and foundational principles of international human rights and humanitarian law. René Provost referred to some of his rescue efforts. It's amazing how they actually spearheaded founding principles in international human rights law. In his distribution of Schutz passes, diplomatic passports, to those who were going to be deported to a certain death, he conferred diplomatic immunity on the recipients. In the establishment of what was called then the International Diplomatic Ghetto, safe houses, he saved thousands more by this route alone. And so he demonstrated the principle and power of diplomatic protection, of diplomatic remedy in the conferral of diplomatic immunity. In establishing soup kitchens, hospitals, daycare centers, enclaves to shelter the vulnerable, women and the elderly, and giving a semblance of dignity amidst the horrors of the Holocaust, he heretofore foreshadowed the principle and power of humanitarian intervention, which our guest Harold Coe has written so much about and actually has made possible. In rescuing thousands consigned to certain death, whether by deportation or death marches, let us remember that from May to July 1944, more than 400,000 Hungarian Jews were deported to the death camps in Auschwitz-Birkenau, the fastest killing field in the entire Holocaust. Raoul Wallenberg arrived in July 1944 and saved the remnant of Hungarian Jews and is credited with saving 100,000 Hungarian Jews in the 6 months that he was in Hungary at the time. As it happens, we meet, and I'm reminded of the fact that we meet on the fifth anniversary of the war in Syria, the scorched earth policy of the Syria's Assad, which has resulted in the greatest humanitarian catastrophe since the Second World War. Some 400,000 that have been killed, 12.5 million people displaced in Syria alone. Some 5 million of them who have become refugees. And the thing that should pain us most is that it all began 5 years ago in a town, Dara, in southern Syria, with young people, with a peace march, with olive branches saying, peace, peace, dignity, dignity. They were disappeared by Assad's people. Those who came to support them were gunned down, and then the scorched earth policy began, which led to the catastrophes that we are witnessing now. Those of us, and I was inspired by Harold Coe's writings on this and other matters, those of us at the time, 1 year later, 2012, wrote about the responsibility to protect, which Wallenberg himself embodied in his personal thing, wrote that where you have a situation of war crimes and crimes against humanity, as we had in Syria at the time, 1 year after the scorched earth policy began, and the government or the country in which it is taking place is unwilling or unable to intervene, or worse, is the author of that criminality,
then there's a responsibility on behalf of the international community to intervene and protect the innocent civilians. Those of us who wrote about that at the time were told, you know, if you intervene, this will lead to sectarian warfare, this will lead to civil war, this will lead to jihadists coming in. Everything we were told that would happen if we would intervene happened because we didn't intervene. ISIS was not there on the map at the time. The rest is tragic history. And Rene mentioned about Wallenberg's singular rescue through his warning to the Nazi generals that they would stand trial for their crimes if they went ahead with blowing up the Budapest ghetto. He was, in a sense, a forerunner of what came to be known as the Nuremberg Principles. Regrettably, the person who saved so many was not saved by so many who could. The Soviet Union, when they came into Hungary, rather than greet him, Raoul Wallenberg, as the rescuer or liberator that he was, imprisoned him, and he then languished in the Gulag. And while it is unclear what his fate was, I just might cite a federal court judgment in the U.S. in 1984, which determined that the evidence was, quote-unquote, incontrovertible, their words, not mine, that Wallenberg did not die in 1947 in the Soviet Gulag or in a prison, as the Soviets have claimed he did. And I'm delighted to be able to say that finally, belatedly, some 20 scholars who have been researching the fate of Raoul Wallenberg will be gathering in Budapest in early summer to try to finally arrive at a determination of what happened to him. And for all these reasons, I'm particularly delighted that Harold Koh is our Raoul Wallenberg lecturer. Yesterday evening, there was a Raoul Wallenberg evening in the University of Ottawa. And the guest speaker there was Ingrid Carlsberg, who just wrote the definitive biography about Raoul Wallenberg. And she said something about Wallenberg, which reminded me from my years of friendship of Harold Koh. She said, what distinguished Wallenberg from everything that she was able to determine after her exhaustive biography? She said it was two things. One, his moral compass, and then his imperative to act. She said it was that combination of that moral clarity and his moral compass and that imperative to act that resulted in him being the great hero of humanity. Well, Harold Koh has been that type of person, an inspirational teacher who's been teaching at Yale Law School for some 30 years now. He also served as a period for a dean at Yale Law School. But here, and I'm speaking, if I may, not just as a friend, but as a somewhat of an expert witness who's been at Yale over the years, and Harold Koh is not just respected, but in fact revered by students and colleagues alike. A distinguished scholar, the author of seminal pieces in international law and international humanitarian law. I have to say that as Minister of Justice and Attorney General, I was the beneficiary, as were people in the Department of Justice and the Canadian government, let alone the American government, the beneficiary of his scholarship. An expert and exceptional public servant, Harold Koh also served as Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor from 1998 to 2001. And then from 2009 to 2013, he was the legal advisor to the U.S. Department of State, for which he received a Secretary of State Distinguished Service Award, and where the international community was the beneficiary of his stewardship at state at the time. An outstanding human rights lawyer and public interest advocate and litigator, he has litigated landmark cases in both the United States and internationally. But the thing I want to speak about, because it all comes together, his teaching, his scholarship, his public service, is that when I would visit at Yale Law School, there were generations of students who were inspired by Harold Koh to engage in public interest advocacy while students at Yale Law School, and then who went on to become some of the best human rights lawyers in the U.S. There cannot be a greater tribute to a law professor than for that law professor to see his students inspiring other generations and the development of law in the United States and internationally. It's no surprise then that he's received some 14 honorary degrees for his scholarship and advocacy and public service and lifetime achievement awards from the American Bar Association, from Columbia Law School, and elsewhere. In a word, he has been a role model for teachers, for scholars, for public servants, for human rights lawyers. And as lecturer, as scholar, as writer, as a public servant, he has served with uncommon moral clarity and compassion. And in so doing, has demonstrated that a law professor and a human rights lawyer, with the compassion to care and the courage to act, has been able, in his own distinguishable way, to transform history. And it's my pleasure to introduce you, Harold Cole.
Well, I'm going to have to fill in a little bit so you can calm down. I am the man who spoke after the introduction by Erwin Cutler. It's a very, very great pleasure to be here. Thank you, Professor Provo. Thank you, Minister General Professor Erwin Cutler, a dear friend for many years. Thank you to Paya Makavan, who will comment after, who has been another friend I've known for many years. It is a very great honor to be here to give the Wallenberg Lecture. Something that Professor Provo said I wanted to emphasize, which is that Wallenberg acted without governmental brief. He was a private citizen who appointed himself to save lives, and which means that every one of us could do the same. And when you think about not just Wallenberg, but Oskar Schindler, Paul Rusesabagina, who you saw in Hotel Rwanda, Rosa Parks. These are people who appointed themselves to save lives. In Hotel Rwanda, if you saw that movie, a hotelier, a hotel keeper, armed only with some keys, a fax machine, some bottles of liquor, and his native ingenuity, starts the episode by saying he doesn't care about the human rights of others. And by the time it's over, he has saved thousands of lives, more than the UN, more than any government, which is a good memory that you can carry away from this lecture, which is that every one of us is responsible and every one of us has something that we can do. Now, I speak here in the face of many heroes from this province in human rights, and they are here: John Humphrey, who one of the drafters of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Erwin Cutler himself, very nice picture, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, who introduced the Charter, Justin Trudeau, who, while I admit he probably didn't spend as much time here, I think is still from Montreal as his writing, Philippe Kirsch, who was the founder, the convener of the Rome Conference on the International Criminal Court, and the first president. It turns out is not from Quebec. I thought he was because his name was Philippe, but I'm American. What can I say? Claire Leroux-Dubé from Quebec City. Louise Arbour, former prosecutor at the ICTY and then Human Rights High Commissioner. Born in French Canada and I think has now returned. Charles Taylor of McGill. This is just a smattering of the remarkable people from this province who have made such an extraordinary impact in the world of human rights. And it's a tradition of which you could be very proud. Now, I should say that the person who introduced me to Montreal is also here, my freshman roommate at Harvard, David Edgel, who I met 45 years ago. He told me that the most famous and most important Quebecer was none of these, but a man named Jean Béliveau, followed closely by Guy Lafleur. And then when we made our first trip here, which is my first trip to Montreal in 1973, in the car on the way up, David, while driving, required us all to sing Hola, 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 le Canadien sola, which is why I have such a great affection for the Canadians, except when they're playing the Boston Bruins. My perspectives on this are, as Irwin has described, 35 years as a professor and scholar, 20 years as a human rights lawyer, 10 in the U.S. government, in the Justice Department, State Department, and 5 years as a dean. Some of these are overlapping, so please don't add them up. I'm not really that old. Here are some pictures of my most recent time in the government. At the upper left, representing the U.S. before the U.N. Human Rights Council, on the upper right in Moscow at the Nuclear Security Summit, the bottom left in Afghanistan, bottom right in Guantanamo, where I have spent more time than I care to remember, starting back in 1991. In fact, my wife pointed out to me that I've worked on issues related to Guantanamo every Christmas since 1991, and it's 2016. This is the most famous picture of me. you've seen this often. This is actually a picture of just after the fall of Gaddafi. A group of us from the State Department, led by Secretary Clinton, went into Libya, and they had put in the middle of this military aircraft these seats, and we sat down, and photographers began to take our picture, and I texted to Secretary Clinton, "Look over your right shoulder." So this iconic picture is actually her reading my text, which says, "Look over your right shoulder." If Wallenberg were alive today, I'm sure the question he'd be asking is, what do we do about Syria? And it's something that you've heard a lot about. Here is Syria, and we'll return to this in a bit. You see these various areas, the left side in red, controlled by the regime, but the yellow areas controlled by the rebels. This was a while back. On the top, yellow and green, the Kurdish regions. In the middle, the gray areas controlled by ISIS, the Islamic State, heading down into Iraq. But I think that the real way to capture what's gone on there is for you to watch two very brief videos. This is the first. This is Syria before the war. You get the idea. It was a beautiful jewel with cultural artifacts, peaceful and lovely. And then I want to show you this, which is taken a few weeks ago. This is from a Russian drone heading over the city of Homs. This is the third largest city in Syria. It was the rebel stronghold, and it's destroyed. It's a ghost town. And obviously this was punishment by the Assad regime for being the capital of the revolution 5 years ago in early 2011. It's been leveled. And so where are the people? They've fled. Now, except for a cessation of hostilities, which does not include a cessation of hostilities involving ISIS, the conflict continues. After 5 years of declaring that Assad must go, of debating whether or not to arm rebel groups, of allowing the red line on chemical weapons to be crossed, where the U.S. has failed to share the refugee burden of Europe in a way that I'll describe, where, depending on who you consult, somewhere from 250 to 500,000 Syrians have died 7 million displaced, 5 million refugees, 2 million of them children. As one person put it, the place where there is more suffering per square foot than anywhere on the planet. The question that we should be asking, and I speak here to both you in the Human Rights Center and also at the law school, is how, if at all, can law and lawyers in human rights improve human rights in Syria and for Syrian refugees at this late date? Here are some of the faces of the Syrian crisis. You have seen this horrible, iconic picture. The civil war, the human rights and humanitarian law violations and armed conflict, the migrant crisis, the border closing, interception at sea in my country, the spectacle of Trumpism, the suggestion of discrimination against Muslim and Syrian refugees who are feared to be ISIS, and the anatomy of a debacle. When I was in the State Department in the late 90s and Assad became the leader of the country, there was hope for him. He was a westernized, English-speaking eye doctor who thought could be someone who might be amenable to democratization and relaxation of authoritarian values. But what we've seen is a broad set of objectives, but only soft power tools, combined with a cynical and persistent Russian veto, four vetoes, which have eliminated the threat of force through the multilateral system with a peace process that has now gone through three different UN special envoys. And now, after declaring that Assad must go, wavering about his future. Perhaps the moment that was most traumatic in August 2013, when it became clear and undeniable that chemical weapons had been used by Assad against innocent civilians, which President Obama had previously said in a televised interview was a red line, which would force him to reconsider his position, which led in August to the U.S. threatening unilateral military action in Syria, but with little evidence of either allied or congressional support. The British Parliament rejected intervention, and soon thereafter, the U.S. also backed off. Which led to, I think, probably the most sickening spectacle of my time as an international lawyer, allowing Vladimir Putin to play the international law card. This is what he said. We're not protecting the Syrian government. We're protecting international law. A U.S. strike would throw the entire system of international law and order out of balance. We must stop using the language of force and return to the path of civilized, diplomatic, and political settlement at the same time as his troops are moving into Crimea. Now, in the last week, we've had some remarkable developments. First, the surprise withdrawal of the Russians from Syria after 5 months. A declaration by the U.S. House of Representatives that ISIS is committing genocide against Christians to be followed by a Senate vote sometime next week. A renewal of the Geneva talks through the work of Secretary of State John Kerry and the envoy Stefan de Mistura. But at a time of extraordinary crisis, I do not think it's an overstatement to say that Greece is breaking. It's facing a double hit on the euro, 1 million refugees. Literally, it cannot cope. And then Europe is under siege. The three central features for what constitutes Europe, the euro, the Schengen zone, and the EU membership when you face Brexit and Grexit, and the leader of Europe, de facto, Angela Merkel, are all teetering. So it's very hard to overstate what a crisis situation we are in Syria, or how much the cascade of problems has threatened the very basis of the post-Cold War order. And we face a replay. When I worked on the Haitian refugee case and the Cuban refugee cases in 1991 through 94, 95, I noticed something which I called in an article the Haiti paradigm in human rights policy, which goes something like this. There is a root cause somewhere, Haiti, Syria, which causes a human rights disaster. So the logical thing would be for concern governments, executive or legislative, to respond to those root causes. But they do not. They do nothing. As a result, refugees flee in large numbers and increasingly panicked ways. This leads to the refugees being treated as the problem, and there's a belated response against the refugees, not against the root causes. Courts are asked to adjudicate, and they end up legitimating the anti-human rights response. And so we end up with an upside-down situation, which is no action on the root causes, and the refugees being subjected to an anti-human rights response, which has been upheld in a court of law. And we are seeing this starting to play out again. So how to avoid this? How to get a better outcome? Now, interestingly, in his last State of the Union address, President Obama mentioned Syria in one sentence, but it led with a prior sentence, which echoed something he had said in several previous speeches. There is a smarter approach, a smart power approach, a patient and disciplined strategy that uses every element of our national power. On issues of global concern, we will mobilize the world to work with us and make sure other countries pull their weight. And then he said, that's our approach to conflicts like Syria, where we're partnering with local forces and leading international efforts to help that broken society pursue a lasting peace. That was it. That was one sentence. You see, looking behind, how persuaded Paul Ryan is by these remarks. What did he mean? What did he mean? Now, here I am inspired by my late friend, a very skilled diplomat, Richard Holbrooke, who I worked with in the Clinton administration and then again in the Obama administration. Richard Holbrooke is a character in and of himself. I could talk about him for hours. The first day I met him and worked with him on something, my wife called me and said, what do you think of Holbrooke? And I said, he's a character. And I said, but if one of our children ever gets kidnapped, send him. there is no one more capable of making a deal. And the approach that I would suggest we pursue is a Syrian smart power strategy, putting into practice what President Obama describes in this one brief sentence, where we do not rely on hard power alone. That's not going to happen. There is no political will in the West to generate a military response, or a purely soft power approach, which, as we have seen over many years, 5 years, is simply not enough to achieve outcomes. The question is how to leverage some smart power, some hard power, some soft power, into a smart power approach with other tools to project refugees, to achieve a ceasefire, to work toward a Syrian Dayton of the kind we had at the end of the Balkans crisis, to fight ISIS, to seek accountability, and eventually oust Assad. That's the big picture. That's where we want to go. And even if we don't have a plan that we can achieve immediately, it's very important to keep this big picture approach in mind, because otherwise we end up in a state of hopelessness. And that's what I find when I talk to people. They literally cannot fathom Syria because they don't know where to begin. And because they don't know where to begin, the answer is let's do nothing. Now, priority one is draining the flood. This is a picture of a dam being drained. I didn't know there are such things, but as we all know, when the flood waters are high, people can't focus on anything but the flood. And this is what's happening now in the replay of the Haiti paradigm. The refugee outflows are so great that people cannot focus on anything but the refugee flows. So priority one is getting the refugee flood under control so that it appears to be orderly, so that we can then address the underlying problem. Now, just 9 days ago, in a provisional grand bargain, the European Union and Turkey agreed in a pretty tit-for-tat deal, that Turkey would take back all new migrants who enter Greece illegally and exchange end the flow of irregular migrants to Greek islands as they are flooding into Lesbos and Perseus, with an agreement that for every Syrian refugee who is returned from Greece to Turkey, the European Union will accept a refugee in the European Union for resettlement. And the EU has expressed a willingness to give aid groups more money to help Turkey, and then, frankly, to pay off the Turks by letting them travel more widely in the Schengen zone without a visa and to speed up consideration of their eventually joining the EU. Now, human rights groups have pointed out, particularly Médecins Sans Frontières, that blanket returns may be illegal to the extent to which they're not giving individualized processing. But the talks continue, and this is now the beginning of a refugee framework. The question is how to work into it stronger humanitarian concerns. Second, we have people coming by boat. And under the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, Article 98, every coastal state party has a duty to promote establishment, operation, and maintenance of adequate and effective search and rescue. Some coastal states, like Greece, are sending rescue boats. Others, like non-governmental organizations, a whole group of them operating off of the Isle of Lesbos, are conducting search and rescue operations. Smugglers are putting people on boats for $1,000. And the question is, how can you target the smugglers collectively through law enforcement effort from the European Union while promoting burden sharing at a broader level? Interestingly, the refugee litigation that I did for the Haitians and the Cubans, in the United States, the U.S. Supreme Court held it was possible to interdict refugees on the high seas and return them to the places that they're fleeing from. But when that litigation ended, we urged people to keep litigating. And this practice of interception and return has been essentially prohibited by the European Court of Human Rights, particularly in recent cases involving Libyan refugees coming to Lampedusa in Italy. So most likely, Syrian refugees will make it to land if they are able to do so. Then what happens? 4 million, some who have been on boats, some who have not been on boats, have fled into neighboring countries, mostly Turkey, Jordan, and Lebanon. Many countries have closed their borders, Jordan, Lebanon, Macedonia, Hungary famously having a referendum. Even Sweden, probably one of the most generous countries in the world, is feeling the heat. Others have imposed severe border limits. In Greece and Italy, 110,000 refugees came in the first 2 months of 2016, that's January and February. But shockingly, here are some countries who have taken no refugees: Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, Qatar, Kuwait, and Bahrain. Here is a graph. So even though people are coming from all these different directions, those states which have oil money and capacity have done absolutely nothing, while Lebanon and Turkey are looking at numbers of over a million. And a number of states are taking deterrent action. You saw today in Calais, where there are large and violent camps, that the French are starting to raise that camp. There was violence famously in Cologne, in Greece, large refugee camps. And then a number of states, including Denmark, recently named the happiest place in the world, to deter Syrian refugees from coming, past an outrageous asylum seekers law, which authorizes police to seek valuables from asylum seekers that are worth more than $1,500. The claim is it's supposed to let them keep their wedding rings, but not much more. I'm advised that this law is going to be challenged, or if not already, before the European Court of Human Rights, that the durational requirements will likely be struck, but we're several years off. And Aleppo is a town divided, the eastern half held by rebels, the western half held by Assad. Many people have fled, and they're fleeing north toward Turkey. And we have mixed reports as to exactly what's happening. You see how close it is. Some people believe that large numbers of Syrian refugees are pooling at the border on the Syrian side. Others say that every once in a while the Turks come and let a group of people over to head toward Adana. But this is a very dangerous zone. So, for example, if planes of Assad's are flying from Damascus, they could very easily bomb refugees, barrel bomb refugees, between the Aleppo and Turkish border as they could in Aleppo itself. And what about my country, the United States? How many refugees from Syria have we taken since 2011? The answer is 121. That's the entire number that we have taken in 5 years. Now, the administration announced a plan to take up to 10,000. Presidential candidate Clinton has called for 65,000. David Miliband at the International Rescue Committee has called for 65,000. But the Republicans, who, if you watch the news, have been obsessed with the notion that every ISIL entrant is, every refugee is actually from ISIL. And the Republican campaign, which is now dwindling to Trump, Cruz, and Kasich, all have essentially the same negative view. Meanwhile, 36 governors of U.S. states have said that Syrians cannot enter their state, which raises major constitutional issues of federalism. I'm proud to say that our state, Connecticut, the governor of Indiana turned one Syrian family away. Instead, they came to Connecticut where they're invited by our governor, and they're living actually in our town, New Haven, Connecticut. Here is your prime minister, still on his honeymoon, but who pioneered welcome refugees, agreeing to take up to 25,000. You can check this website by the minute. And this was yesterday's number, 28,439 arrived or approved for admission. An admirable performance by the country of honorary citizenship for Raoul Wallenberg. So, this is the situation. It's a mess. How do we think about what to do about it? And here let me suggest a plan. It's not a perfect plan, but it is the elements of a plan. Number one, ending the war. We are in the middle of a week or so of cessation of hostilities. Cessation of hostilities to a ceasefire is a little bit like a temporary restraining order to a permanent injunction. The cessation of hostilities seems to be holding on and off, although there's still violence. The question is it because they're simply so tired, or is there more? Secretary Kerry has taken the lead with the Mistura in negotiating the expansion into a ceasefire. But I think it's time at this moment to use the unexpected Russian withdrawal to further pressure Assad to negotiate with his adversaries. And there's a need in this process where we have a group, the ISSG, the International Syria Support Group, to engage in confidence building. For now, I think it's sufficient not to address the issue of Assad, keeping in mind the precedent of Milosevic in the former Yugoslavia, where nobody said that he wasn't a war criminal. They just needed him to make the deal, and so they let it go until Dayton was concluded, and only after that was he forced out and ended up dying while on trial at the Yugoslav Tribunal in The Hague. A new idea put forward by my former colleague Phil Gordon is the notion of a Syrian Dayton, in which the Kerry negotiations do not accept the premise which has been operating up until now, which is you must have a political settlement to get to peace. That theory doesn't work because people keep dying. So can we somehow have peace first and a political settlement after? And the way to do this is to try to extend the cessation of hostilities into a legitimate ceasefire, and then to move into what are called partition safe zones, where the regime controls the west, the Kurds are in the northeast, the Sunni opposition is in the north and south. ISIS, for the time being, is in the central and eastern part, but war continues against them. Let me just show you this again with this picture. So we have here the regime in red. If the opposition can control or consolidate areas here and here, the Kurds are the green plus these areas. And if you saw today's New York Times, they're already seeking a confederal situation. And if the Allies can take back Raqqa, then the ISIS parts would be located here. Part of the theory would be to concentrate the fighting here. Ramadi is obviously a contested center within Iraq. The Iraqi forces are strengthening. Assad's forces are still bombing Palmyra. But you would have a stand-in-place ceasefire, which amounts to a partition. Also as a confidence-building measure, to call for prisoner releases, armistice lines, zones of local autonomy, and humanitarian supply routes. And then for the UN-convened negotiation to continue on the future of a unified federal Syrian state. Now, the one thing that nobody agrees to is that there would be an ISIS permanent area. And the real question is, how strong exactly are the ISIS groups, or are they losing force? It was pretty clear that Russia being there using military force was not helping, in that they were directing most of their fire toward enemies of Assad. How about this? Is it possible to create a no-fly zone here, or a humanitarian access corridor from Aleppo to the Turkish border, in which a humanitarian corridor is combined with a no-fly zone, or at least so that helicopters of Assad's, which are dropping barrel bombs on civilians, their takeoff platforms are destroyed? This is what the U.S. did for NATO in the Libyan intervention, for which the U.S. has been hugely criticized, although it clearly saved thousands of lives and was clearly lawful under international law, under two Security Council resolutions. Whether a safe haven should be created or whether it would be a good policy is much debated. Obviously, the Russians have claimed that they entered Syria under international law with Assad's consent. Could you establish a humanitarian corridor or safe zone in Syrian territory and airspace without Assad's consent? That would lead to Assad and the Russians labeling it illegal. And we have the dilemma of safe zones themselves, safe havens. Since Srebrenica, people are obviously loath to go to safe havens because they might not be safe. And why be there like sitting ducks? You cannot have a safe zone without adequate forces to protect, or at least a no-fly zone. And a logical question, what if you built a safe haven and no one came? It's a heavy lift. But the truth of it is that refugees don't want to be caught between Aleppo and the Turkish border. They want to be in Germany. And so it may well be that this safe zone option, which will be explored, I'm sure, in great detail in Geneva, is not worth the candle. Nevertheless, it deserves to be a subject of continued discussion. What about the refugees? I call to your attention your distinguished Canadian human rights expert, Michael Ignatieff, former leader of the Liberal Party, now at the Kennedy School at Harvard, has convened a group of students at the Shorenstein Center who put together a comprehensive plan of action for Syrian refugees at a very high level of detail. And Michael and colleagues, particularly Leon Wessel-Tier, have written important articles recently in both the New York Review of Books and the New York Times. Their position, with which I agree, is quite simple, that the United States has to be more involved, not because the United States' action will solve the problem, but because otherwise the U.S. has no credibility to be at the table to solve the problem. And that one way to do that is for the United States to take up to 100,000 more refugees, not 10, not 65, but 100,000 more, which is a small number compared to, say, the million Cuban refugees they took in the 60s, to establish that the U.S. is ready to put more on the table than just some money. Now, the real reason why this may happen or may be important is because of the threat to Angela Merkel. If Merkel collapses because of hostility to her policies, as has been signaled by the recent side elections in Germany, the U.S. is in big trouble. And the U.S., therefore, needs to come to the table with Germany to support a plan of Europe-wide burden sharing and to manage the refugee flows by enhanced diplomacy with Turkey and Jordan. What would that look like? The basic thought would be that Turkey would be the staging area and processing center, that the EU would disperse $3 billion promised under a joint action plan so that Turkey has structures to process refugees in individualized and orderly manner consistent with international law, as well as to improve their living conditions in Turkey itself. There's another $3 billion that may be accessible, and the U.S. could come up with some more. It might be something that Obama would be requesting from a lame duck Congress. But then as further confidence-building measures, Germany and the United States doing more so that refugee camps are not simply warehousing facilities but have expanded educational opportunities and job training. If this model were to work in Turkey, along with other kinds of inducements being given to the Turks, it could be replicated in Jordan and Lebanon. What about number three, longer term? Oh, I should have mentioned. Where is the money going to come from on this? There are millions of dollars of frozen Syrian assets that have been frozen by UN Security Council resolutions. Normally, the principle is that you do not cannibalize frozen assets to give to refugees because you want to give it back to the country when they've had a transition. But if what we end up with for the near future is that Assad is in charge of Syria, why would we want to unfreeze the assets and give them to him? Why not unfreeze the assets and give them to refugee humanitarian relief? And it seems to me that a critical aspect of this is aggressive bilateral diplomacy with China, Russia, Saudi Arabia, the Arab states, to say, if you don't take refugees, you have to give money. And on this, particularly, Saudi Arabia has been egregious scofflaw, and if they are able to be flipped, they would put pressure on their Gulf colleagues to do the same. On the longer term, there's a need for real commitments. It turns out that this is the year of the humanitarian summit. There are humanitarian summit in May, but in September 2016, at the UN, at Obama's last visit to the General Assembly, there will be two humanitarian summits, one convened by the UN and the other convened by the US. And there's a further discussion of convening a private relief humanitarian summit, so really three. And the question is how to use these as pledging conferences to get real commitments from countries who have been avoiding being at the table. This is something on which President Obama could put a huge amount of personal energy. After all, he'll only be 2 months away from leaving office. Now, what about the High Commissioner for Refugees? Guy Goodwin-Gill, who is one of the most distinguished refugee advocates, has made a brilliant argument that, in fact, all of the expansion of the mandate of the High Commissioner's office can be done by a single General Assembly resolution, which could be introduced at the same time, thus that UNHCR has, in fact, adapted its practices without legal mandate to address many of these issues. It's also an occasion to tap into private sources like Google, Starbucks, Airbnb and Uber, who have already given money for relief, for real private relief. And then fourth, when we brought up the issue, as Irwin did, of Raoul Wallenberg giving out diplomatic passports, it shows how important it is for refugees to have identification. It's a vetting device. And we have been operating in an international system where nation states are the ones who create passports and diplomatic programs. But during the war, World War II, there were internationally recognized passports for refugees. It may well be that one of the projects of the new High Commissioner expanded mandate is to develop an internationally authorized biometric ID card, which creates the possibility that international entities authorize travel across borders with exit and entry times in a way that can legalize and regularize flows. Finally, and not to be forgotten, is the issue of accountability. I'm sure my colleagues here at McGill, Payam, and Professor McGray will have things to say on this point. This has been frustrated by the fact that in 2014, the Security Council referral of the case at the initiative of the French to the International Criminal Court was double vetoed by Russia and China. No one believes that Assad is solely responsible. He is simply at the head of what is called the deep state. But a group called the Commission on International Justice and Accountability has built individual cases against more than two dozen senior Syrian officials. A photographer named Caesar has taken a bunch of photographs, which are now being widely distributed. The Syrian Commission of Inquiry under Paulo Pinheiro has been repeatedly renewed through the use of social media. Mapping of conflict sites has continued to create patterns and practice. And then groups like the Syrian Justice Accountability Center, the Syrian Observatory on Human Rights, have done an outstanding job building dossiers. What may be the case is if there is an extraordinary political will, you could find a situation where an ad hoc tribunal would be created. I understand that to be a heavy lift. Or that universal domestic jurisdiction could be exercised in different European countries, particularly Belgium, France, Germany, Spain. At a minimum, there should be the creation of a missing persons commission of the kind we found in the Balkans, ICMP, and the release, a call for the release of people who have been arbitrarily detained. Whether there would be a truth and reconciliation down the process down the road is obviously a much longer question, but we have lots of experience with that, as Irwin could well testify. And then finally, fifth, not to forget fighting ISIS or ISIL, how to reduce their scope in central and eastern Syria. Secretary Clinton gave a detailed and thoughtful speech on this subject, which argues that the U.S. must continue to work with the Kurds as their ground forces, particularly the Peshmerga, that in Iraq, Iraqi forces can also be enlisted, that there's a real possibility of exploiting the Russian withdrawal. Secretary Kerry has argued that there's a likelihood that the Allies can reclaim Raqqa, that the Iraqi forces have been strengthened, and to disrupt and dismantle an infrastructure that's facilitating the flow of foreign fighters into Syria, financing arms and propaganda, and then of massive interest, particularly after the Paris and San Bernardino, hardening homeland defenses against external and homegrown threats. And then the newest feature of this, countering ISIL's propaganda through the internet, which has made them one of the most aggressive recruiters, and which has raised huge issues now of privacy in the famous Apple case. The remarkable thing about the Apple case is apparently the information on the cell phone was available and they locked it. And now the question is, how can they unlock something they locked, which obviously should be a call for a change of law enforcement protocol. Maybe you don't agree with any of this. Maybe you agree with some of it. But my point is this. There is a smart power strategy available to be worked on. It includes bringing down the flow of refugees. It includes starting the process of extending a cessation of hostilities into a Syrian Dayton. It includes humanitarian relief efforts to create orderly refugee outflows. It includes a campaign against ISIL that will shrink them like the tumor that they are. And it includes longer-term humanitarian relief efforts that can be pursued on a multilateral basis. If I were to extrapolate from what President Obama's one sentence at the State of the Union might mean, it is this. But the important thing to say is that doing nothing is not our only option. Because we are in the remarkable situation that we have been continuing to bomb ISIL, leaving Assad largely alone, even though he's the cause of the refugee crisis to which we're responding. And I have to cite Mitt Romney to take down Donald Trump, the leading presidential candidate on one side. This is what Romney said. What Trump said on 60 Minutes about Syrian ISIS has to go down as the most ridiculous and dangerous idea of this campaign season. Let ISIS take out Assad, and then we can pick up the remnants. Think about that. Let the most dangerous terrorist organization the world has ever known take over a country. This is recklessness in the extreme. Now, Mitt Romney is not going to be president. Trump is now in a leading position. A final issue, and this is one that was flagged by Irwin, is the notion that it's an intervention into territorial sovereignty in violation of the UN Charter to breach Syrian sovereignty for the purpose of creating a safe haven or no-fly zone or humanitarian corridor. And people argue that Article 2.4 is absolute in the sense of barring interventions. Think about that. If Article 2.4 is absolute, any P5 member could commit genocide against its own citizens, veto Security Council resolutions, and nobody could do anything above it. And it suggests that in the purposes of the UN, which include, as an important purpose, protecting human rights, the only value that counts is sovereignty. To me, this is an absolutist reading that mirrors what you would expect from someone like Robert Bork, not what a sensitive international lawyer's reading of the UN Charter means. Surely, it seems to me, the West can provide humanitarian aid inside Syria, create humanitarian corridors. Whether they have the capacity under international law to support Syrian rebels is an even more complicated question. But notice that in 2009, in his Nobel Prize speech, President Obama said explicitly, "I believe that force can be justified on humanitarian grounds as it was in the Balkans or in other places that have been scarred by war. Inaction tears at our conscience and can only lead to more costly intervention later." He could have been speaking about Syria. And we have the well-known precedent of Kosovo, where diplomacy backed by force made the R2P movement go forward, where 19 NATO countries used force for 78 days outside the Security Council framework to abate Milosevic's abuses. Only the U.S. failed to state an international legal rationale. The Brits stated a rationale, the Danes, the Belgians. Many international lawyers said, this is illegal but legitimate. Now, I ask you to think about that. Have you ever heard anyone say same-sex marriage is illegal but legitimate? Do we accept an ambiguous legal state for something that we believe to be right, or do we move to make it lawful? If a woman in self-defense kills a battered spouse without the indicia of self-defense normally required, do we say it's illegal but legitimate, or do we in fact develop a legal rationale that supports it? Where else do we accept this? It seems to me that the absolutist reading creates an intolerable bias toward inaction, and it's a time to define now, 20 years after Kosovo, when it is lawful to exercise a responsibility to protect. This is something that my friend Erwin Cutler has done And I think the most important thing to recognize is this. As Erwin said, when everyone is intervening in Syria, the non-intervention position is not pro-peace, it is pro-slaughter, where Western powers are invoking the legal rules as a reason to do nothing. And Erwin, in one of his editorials on this subject, said, since when did a responsibility to protect become a right to protect Syrian massacres? After Kosovo, an international commission, which was commissioned by the Canadian government, said, if the Security Council fails to discharge its responsibilities in a conscience-shocking situation, it's unrealistic to expect that other states will rule out other means and forms of action. And I think that that couldn't apply more clearly than where we are today. In an article I have forthcoming, I argue that you can have a responsibility to protect test, which is narrowly drawn. When you have disruptive consequences likely to lead to imminent threats to peace and security, other remedies have been exhausted, the use of force is limited, necessary, and proportionate, and the action is collective, and the means are illegal, for example, barrel bombs or chemical weapons, and the ends are illegal, namely war crimes, crimes against humanity, or genocide. A exercise of the responsibility to protect is permissible. It's like the Good Samaritan principle in tort. You don't pre-authorize, but if people act as good Samaritans, you exempt them from wrongfulness after the fact. You acknowledge that what they do is in tension with the letter of the law, but it is justified by an affirmative defense. It seems to me that this is something lawyers should do in service of human dignity, which is not simply to say that a rule is a rule is a rule, when the result of the rule is that innocent people are being left constantly to die. And then finally, we have the challenge of the so-called crime of aggression, about to be finalized in 2017 by the International Criminal Court. One question that remains open, and I've written about this with a colleague in the American Journal of International Law this year, if Western leaders act to prevent crimes against humanity, genocide, war crimes, and massive refugee outflows, can they be prosecuted for aggression? If so, that will make it exceedingly difficult to mobilize a coalition of the Kosovo kind. And think about this. It means that there is no possibility of prevention of these gross abuses. The only remedies are post hoc. What sense does that make? Finally, there is a temptation in times of crisis to apply what I call the Turner Doctrine. What's law got to do with it? What's law but a sweet old-fashioned notion? But 21st century law is not a black hole. Lawyers do have a role to play in addressing it. The hour is late and many have perished. But there are still things that we can do in Syria. If you don't like what I've outlined, please think about what you could outline, or the important role that Canada can play in this discussion under your new government, which has started on such a promising note in the human rights field. And finally, this. There is still time to remember Raoul Wallenberg, who saved as many as 100,000 Jews in Budapest, who for that reason became the first honorary citizen of Canada and the second honorary citizen of the United States after Winston Churchill. And the words that he said in a haunting way, I will never be able to go back to Sweden without knowing inside myself I've done all a man can do to save as many Jews as possible. Nobody appointed him, he appointed himself. Can we each take a moment to think, have we done all that we could to save as many Syrians as possible? And if we have had that thought, then we would have done a good service on the day of this 2016 Wallenberg lecture. Thank you very much.
Okay, so we have about 15 minutes or so for questions. If you could walk over to the microphone to ask your questions, that would be very much appreciated so that everyone in the room can hear. And so we can just start to the left. Yes.
Clearly, any relief of killing and suffering is desirable. But surely we must establish firm guidelines that do more than just provide cosmetic changes that still allow killing and suffering to continue despite minimal efforts that make things look better. So how can we establish these guidelines and get important nations to act on them? Because right now the ideas are fuzzy, not specific enough, not have no compulsion to them. They're just desirable aims rather than important obligations. We're talking about law, so international law, what mechanism can we use to clarify what must be done and how it's to be done in these kind of perilous situations?
Thank you. Let's take two at a time so that we get more people a chance to speak. So maybe
Professor Cole, thank you for another outstanding presentation today. In a way of metaphoric parentheses, I would just say that my good friend, the governor of Ohio, doesn't necessarily agree that Trumpism dominates the GOP. But my question is not really about politics. Without disagreeing with your learned observation about the surprise of Vladimir Putin's withdrawal of certain Russian forces from Syrian sovereign territory, might there be an unsurprising reason? Might the deployment of American tactical air power in the area have convinced the Russian civilian and military leader that further deployment of Russian forces and engagement with those forces would lead to perhaps further air-to-air engagements with the Turkish F-16s? In other words, after the fact, seeing Russian withdrawal is a reflection of the proper projection of American power. And just very, very quickly, anyone interested in further reading about Turkey and the European migrant crisis, I highly commend this issue of The Economist. But I'm interested in your views about the projection of American power as making the Russian withdrawal not really that surprising after the fact. Thank you.
Well, to the question on this side, the purpose of my presentation is not that you agree with what I said so much as that you sense that there is something to be done. When I returned to academia, I found that people would often say, see, the mistake was made 5 years ago, and since we didn't do anything then, we're stuck. When you're in the government, your job is to get it from where it is now to a better place. And the reason that I invoke Holbrooke and the Balkans was that when I went to the government, everyone said the Balkans would collapse and there was no solution. By the time we had left, you had a Dayton Accord, you had an ICTY, Yugoslav Tribunal, you had the leaders out of office and being eventually pursued before the criminal tribunals, and you've had a peace in Bosnia that's held for 20 years. It's a cold peace, but it's better than what was there. Which means that the statement is so murky and muddy and there are no rules and we can't do anything. I just outlined about 50 steps that you can do, starting with step one. And if people think that the legal rules are an obstacle, then start working on those legal rules. That's my point, which is just because it's complicated and people think there's no way to begin leads to a sense of hopelessness. But frankly, we can't have a solution that focuses only on how to keep refugees out of my country, which is essentially what's going on now. That's the Haiti paradigm. In response to the comment over here, I don't think the U.S. has over-projected its power. I think the mistake is that the United States has two enemies in Syria, ISIL and Assad. And it seems to me that President Obama is focusing his energy on ISIL, but not Assad. And I think the Russians, frankly, Putin, who's strapped in many ways, probably figured, I know a quagmire when I've seen it, and we lived through Afghanistan, and we've gotten most of what we want out of 5 months here, and so time to pull back. Now, maybe he thought that Assad is strong enough that he can survive now on his own. But if that were so, why would he pull out in the middle of the beginning of the cessation of hostilities? This is a great moment to reinforce the position and make the negotiations in Geneva work. And just because the negotiations in Geneva have failed a couple times before, the more the Russians are involved with those negotiations, the more they have to support a Security Council resolution to back it up. Because if they are being flouted, then it's an insult to them. So I think that we are in a moment of potential traction on this diplomatic issue. Now, I honestly think that with ISIL, the two prongs of this are cutting off ISIL's flows so it's not expanding, and then secondly, moving them into less and less attractive areas of Syria and Iraq. The truth is, would you want to be part of ISIL? One of the things I did in the State Department was we did a lot of studies about terrorists, and most people don't want to kill themselves. Most people don't want to put on suicide vests and die when they're 21 years old. They may be miserable economically, but then in Somalia, for example, they'll take a couple acres of land and a cow and fight for a couple years in these forces and then get out. So I think the question is how to disincentivize people from joining this, and one way to do it is for them to think it's a failed mission or it's not going to achieve this kind of success. Everybody wants to emulate Al-Qaeda in the same way as every rock group wants to emulate the Beatles. They were the last successful, really successful group. But if you make them less and less attractive and create other alternatives. So, for example, if you do this partition of Syria, it might well be that a lot of the people who are in ISIS would rather go to one of the areas which they're not fighting for their lives and start doing something else. And it's creating a plausible, peaceful alternative. That's essentially what happened in Bosnia. I'll never forget, people told me in Kosovo, you're never going to be able to get people to disarm because they want to wear cool uniforms. And so what we did was we had a New York costume designer come in, and he made the demining uniforms look like uniforms that cool military soldiers would wear, where the young 21-year-old guys would whip out these huge demining equipment. And suddenly everybody wanted to be in the demining corps when they previously had been carrying around AK-47. So this can work at many levels, but it's a psychological exercise that has to be carried out with lots of ingenuity, private money, persistence, etc.
Yes, sir, please.
Thank you for such an illuminating lecture, Professor Koh. There was a very recent long article in Atlantic Magazine. It was an interview by Jeffrey Goldberg with President Obama, a series of interviews, and he called the article the Obama Doctrine. And quickly, I'll read two things to you, which and I'd like you to know your response on how President Obama has explained why he has proudly resisted going into Syria. He said, the notion is that if you called for Assad to go, but you didn't force him to go, you did not invade. This is what Obama is saying that people have challenged him with. And the notion, and he responds, and the notion is that if you weren't going to overthrow the regime, you shouldn't have said anything. Well, that's a weird argument to me. The notion that if we use our moral authority to say this is a brutal regime and this is not how a leader should treat his people, once you do that, you are obliged to invade the country and install a government you prefer. And one other sentence that he said explains his extreme reticence to go into Syria, or it seems any other country, because, and he brought up the Vietnam analogy, because he's so concerned about getting trapped, and you used the word quagmire just now, and becoming part of a quagmire. I asked says Goldberg, Obama about retrenchment. Quote, almost every great power has succumbed to overextension, he said. What I think is not smart is the idea that every time there's a problem, we send in our military to oppose order. We just can't do that. So here's a president who is viscerally opposed to intervention because, and he brought up Libya. He said, we went into Libya and we made a mess of it. You drew a very detailed and precise response to protect agenda. Do you think that somebody like Obama, who has these instincts, would and I know that Kerry was very much pushing him, according to the article, and going in. Do you think that Obama would be influenced by a very structured response to protect and get over his sense of let's stay out of places where we're not sure of a good result?
Thank you. And we will take the question from the gentleman behind you, which will be our last question for tonight as well.
Good evening. The Civil War was already raging for 4.5 years in Syria before the famous picture which you showed on one of your slides attracted the attention of the world. I venture to say if that picture had not been, if that situation had not taken place, and there's some doubts now as to the authenticity of the way it actually happened, there's some stories about the boy actually being on a part of land further inland and somebody placing his body right next to the sea. But that's neither here nor there. I venture to say that probably if you'd be here today, you'd be speaking about a different subject. I'd like to have your explanation of how the world is so mediatized today that if it's not on video, it doesn't exist. We were hardly seeing visions of the refugees going day by day because it was something that the West wasn't concerned about until that picture came to the fore. And my second question is, a few days ago, on the Macedonia-Greek border, they were letting in, they were distinguishing between refugees from Damascus, which was not considered in the absolute war zone of Syria, and the ones who were coming from the absolute war zones where they were in danger of their lives, in a way indicating that perhaps among the legitimate refugees are people who are not in immediate danger and are actually economic refugees seeking asylum in the West, particularly in Germany, just to improve their lives and just taking advantage of the rest of the people who are actually really serious refugees, seriously in danger of their lives if they would stay in Syria or in the neighboring countries.
So to this last question, you know, the wolf is at the door. We can't wait anymore. Europe is collapsing. Greece is collapsing. If Merkel is voted out, and if all of the right-wing parties are elected who all adopt Trumpist approaches, and they all are barring refugees, then Turkey will collapse. And if this comes at a moment when, Great Britain decides to leave the Eurozone, where Schengen collapses, and Greece leaves the Eurozone, we don't have a partner anymore, the United States and Canada. So I don't think we have the luxury to do nothing, because by doing nothing till now, we got ourselves to this situation. Which goes to the other very thoughtful question. Why did President Obama say what he said? I'm sure, by the way, everything I've said has been said to him pretty much every day by Samantha Power and John Kerry and others. Nobody's talking about taking over Syria. I mean, this is not George W. Bush. Nobody's talking about sending hundreds of thousands of U.S. boots on the ground into Syria to occupy it. What we're talking about is whether an assertion of humanitarian support could mobilize a diplomatic process. Now, for example, why did they remove chemical weapons? Because Obama put the threat of force on the table, and then the Russians decided to cooperate, and then suddenly the chemical weapons were removed, and the international OPCW was able to both act and win the Nobel Peace Prize. So it shows that when a smart power approach includes a threat of force, you're able to motivate some action. You know, why did Milosevic come to the table? Because he was getting bombed. You know, why might Assad come to the table and stay at the table to make a deal? Because he thinks that it's the best deal he's going to get. And that's where this comes in. Now, President Obama, I think, wanted to leave office having defeated ISIS, defeated Al-Qaeda, pulled out of Iraq, and pulled out of Afghanistan. When I left the government, it looked like that was possible. And then Iraq destabilized with ISIS, and Afghanistan, the Taliban resurged, and while Al-Qaeda core was weakened, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and ISIS and then other groups, Nusra and Al-Shabaab and others, have come in. So now we're fighting a multiple front war. And I think he doesn't want to leave the legacy of having gone into another country. I think he spent his humanitarian intervention card on Libya. But where he has put energy is into these important multilateral negotiations. The Iran nuclear deal, which I think is successful. The Paris climate change deal, which I think is successful. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TTIP, are both under discussion. And the question is whether the administration could finish with a ceasefire arrangement that leads to something in Syria to be carried on by the next president, who, it's Hillary Clinton, will be very much of the same mindset. Now, part of this, it seems to me, is beating back ISIS. And that's where I think that if the Russians have disengaged, they weren't doing much on ISIS anyway. But part of it is giving up on a full-fledged process involving elections in 18 months and getting a ceasefire and stand in place and partitioning of the country. Yeah, remember, a lot of these lines were drawn artificially a hundred years ago anyway. And the Kurds have been fighting ever since to recreate an entity, and they're doing pretty well in terms of creating their own zone, and they'll fight for it. So my view on this is there is a big, big difference. Could we go back? What if the resources that were devoted to invading Iraq were instead devoted to going after bin Laden in Tora Bora in the first month, and then trying to use some of that resources to stabilize and strengthen Afghanistan? We would be living in a very different world than we've been living in since 2003. But you can't go back in the same way. You just have to figure out a way to move forward from the place where we were to the place where we're going to be. I think what you see from President Obama is a statement that that's where he's planning to end it up. It's too bad, because in the last year of his administration, where not much is going to be happening because of the election, is a critically important time for this. I very much credit John Kerry. John Kerry seems deeply motivated and has been saying it. I think John Kerry wanted to make a deal in the Middle East. That's appeared impossible. So he's thrown his energies into this, and I think he'll work on this until the day he goes out. And so all of which is to say, if you think it's hopeless, it's hopeless. If you think there's nothing to advocate, then there's nothing to advocate. But, you know, Wallenberg, if someone said to him, start saving Jews in Budapest, he could have easily said, oh, that's hopeless. Or if you told Ruth Sesabagina in Rwanda, save people by bringing them to your hotel, he could have just said, forget it. But, you know, human rights is, as the folks here in this room know better than I, is fight one at a time. But the main thing is have a strategy, and a strategy that you're ready to pursue and put some energy into. I think the Trudeau government here has enormous role to play with the optimism. They put their skin in the game by taking 28,000 refugees. I think they can motivate others to act. As I said at the very beginning, it's part of this great Canadian human rights tradition that is so deeply ingrained into who you are as a nation.
All right, so let me just invite my colleague, Professor Paula McAvan, to wrap this up.
Thank you, Renee. It's a great pleasure to have had this evening with you, Harold. And when you were speaking about Bosnia and the Dayton Peace Accord, it reminded me of the first time I heard about you, which was in 1995, at the eve of the Dayton Peace Accords, when the outstanding interns that I was receiving at the prosecutor's office of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, The Hague, would say, "Harold this, Harold that." And I said, "Who is this Harold fellow that these students are talking about all the time?" And that question finally led me to my first academic appointment at Yale Law School, courtesy of yourself. So it's a particular privilege to use this opportunity to thank you for all the extraordinary work that you've done, and also to tell my students that have suffered from my teaching, who's responsible for my academic career. If you have any complaints, you can speak to this gentleman right here. But I did also recall the exact same debates that we're having today taking place at that time. The political realists saying, well, what can be done about Bosnia, except to appease Slobodan Milosevic, except to embrace the reality of a partition, ratification of the gains made by ethnic cleansing. And it was one Richard Holbrooke and a number of advocates such as yourself that said that the ICTY is non-negotiable. Accountability is non-negotiable, not just as a matter of naive idealism, but because there would be no future for Bosnia if war criminals and hate mongers continue to occupy positions of power. And I think it's especially welcome that you have reignited that debate at a time when the question of the atrocities of the Assad regime seem to have been conveniently swept under the carpet. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights has estimated that 95% of civilian atrocities are the result of the crimes of the Assad regime, even if we have now become perhaps distracted by these social media spectacles of ISIS. So I want to thank you very much for your leadership, intellectually and otherwise. And with your permission, while you were speaking, I drafted a short email that I wanted to read for you. Dear Mrs. Clinton, are you looking for a new Secretary of State? So on that note, I will end perhaps with a short poem from my Persian cultural tradition, by Rumi, who says, "Raise your words and not your voice. It is rain that grows the flowers and not thunder." And I'm especially delighted and honored to have a colleague whose words are so elevated, but who also has the practical sense of making real change in the real world. So thank you once again.
Renee, could I just close by saying how grateful I am to be here? I just wanted to recall something that happened after the moment that Payam has described. After the bombing of Kosovo, I went back to Pristina as Assistant Secretary for Human Rights, and I was in a room of refugees. Like, it was actually laid out by this room. In fact, that was the first thing I thought of when I came in here. And there was a group of several hundred people, Kosovars, who had been in refugee camps, who had just returned to the newly autonomous Kosovo. And they said to me, "Mr. Secretary, we would like you to swear these people in as the new judges of the new state of Kosovo." And so I said, "Okay, that will be my honor." And then I said, Could everybody please stand up in this room? Everybody stood up. And then I said, what are we going to swear them on? And then there was suddenly this discussion. We couldn't swear them on the Bible because most of them were not Christians. We couldn't swear them on the Koran because many of them were not Muslims. We couldn't swear them on the Constitution of Yugoslavia because Yugoslavia was the state that was repressing them. And so then I said to them, what should we swear you on? And one man in the back raised his hand and said, swear us on the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So we found in the library 100 copies of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and we found 100 copies of the European Convention of Human Rights, and we brought it in, and they all put their hands on it. And then some people said, I want the Koran too, so we put that under there. And we swore them in as judges of the new state of Kosovo. And that, to me, shows that even after the worst atrocities, there is hope, there is rule of law, there is a commitment to human rights, which is now universal and transcends even the worst and bleakest moments. So I hope we can consider that in the future as the Syrian crisis continues to unfold. Thank you. Thank you for giving me the chance to do it.